December 5th, 2013, this is the follow-up interview with Kathy Middlecamp. We're again here in her office in Science Hall, and I am Troy Reeves. So Kathy, as we did last time, if you could say your name and spell your last name.
I am Kathy Middlecamp. Middle, M-I-D-D-L-E, Camp, C-A-M-P, Middlecamp.
Perfect, thank you. You said, just as this was in test mode, that you had a story that you thought would be a good start for this
Yes.
interview.
Yes. And actually, it fits with the conversation we were having before you turned on the recorder, which is when we think about the past, we make up the stories because we don't really remember them all, and they get conflated. And the story I was going to start with was over in the law school, there is a professor who is now retired. He hosted me and I want to say three other academic staff buddies of mine from ASEC, and we went over to talk to him about getting academic staff members seated on standing university committees, like the Committee on Women, because some academic staff members are women, the Committee on Minorities and Disadvantaged Students, committees on all sorts of things. What I remember is now every time I pass that office, I flinch. This is 20, almost 30 years later. I don't remember really what happened in the office. He told us, in essence, there would never be anybody seated on any of those committees, and we were wasting his time to get out of his office. Something probably to that effect. I have no idea what the words are. But the memory, the physical memory, when I go by that, I go, oh, that's where so-and-so was. And I remember how I felt. And this is all those years later. So that's a story that, although you don't know the details, you remember you felt like nothing, and I was really angry. Of course, the happy ending to the story is, of course, we're all on the committees now. But there was a time we weren't. And we were some of the forerunners saying, you know, I think we all need to be in this together. And he didn't throw us out, but he left us feeling like 2 cents on a very big dollar. And I know his name, and I know he's retired, and I'm just choosing not to enter his name into the record.
What about the people that were with you? Would you feel comfortable telling me who they were?
I'm guessing it was somebody like Char Twitterisi or Bill Steffenhagen, or could have even been Phil Hellmuth from Letters in Science, South Hall. It was one of the groups. It could have been Anne Wallace, mm-hmm. who was on PPPC, or all those, some initials, personnel policies, procedures, and I don't know who, if I told you who the, I can tell you off the record who the guy was, and they may remember going in the office.
Well, we can talk about that after.
Yeah, but I remember being angry and hurt, and I don't know the details, but I do know when I walk by it, I still remember.
Mm-hmm. You remember the physical feeling?
Yes.
Is this an example? At the end, you were talking about how roadblocks, at the end of last time's conversation, you were talking about how once you got into graduate school and during the 80s and the 90s, roadblocks were put in front of you. Could this be an example of that?
This would be one. I had no idea that there were committees that we weren't welcome to be seated on. And of course, we didn't want to be on tenure committees, but ones that were on the life and the functioning of campus seemed a pretty natural place that all of us had something to contribute.
Right. And by that point, I mean, academic staff had governance or shared governance.
Yes.
So it wasn't that you were asking for something that we as academic staff didn't already have.
Right. But he was probably the chair of the university committee, and that's why we were going to talk to him. And there were many UC chairs after him, like Rich Ralston and others, that we just delighted in working with. We knew there were some things we could change, there were some things we couldn't, but this particular gentleman in the law school had his opinions, told us, and dismissed us.
Mm-hmm. I can see why you flinch when you watch that.
Sorry, I go, oh, I know, that's where this guy was. I remember him.
So I do want to talk more about academic staff, and maybe we'll talk about that first before we talk a bit more about your professional I mean, academic staff is part of your professional development, obviously, but talk about your jobs during the 80s and 90s. So we ended last time with you becoming involved in academic staff, and you said that basically you just decided to run for ASEC and you won a seat. Is that...
I did.
Is that still...
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And I remember the feeling of surprise that I won, and I don't remember much else of who I ran against. And I also remember the feeling when I landed in the room, not having a clue what they were talking about. They were talking in alphabet soup. Mm. I mean, ASEC is an example of it.
Right.
Academic Staff Executive Committee, UC, University Committee. System, they were talking all about system. All of the committees had abbreviations, like I'm sure it was Ann Wallace with PPP and C. But there were six other standing committees of the academic staff. They all had initials, too. I didn't know what they were talking about. Had to climb a learning curve.
Yeah, did you... expose isn't exactly the right word, but in that first meeting or early on, expose them to the fact that, you know, this alphabet soup program on campus was something that you knew nothing about?
I don't remember. Okay. Oh, APCs, too. That was another, an academic planning council.
Okay.
You know, this one at the school, the college level. There were VCs, there were AVCs. There was administrative code. We do that at the National Science Foundation. We all talk about DUE. Oh, that's the Division of Undergraduate Education. Hmm. So it's perfectly normal. It was a world that I didn't know existed because I had been in the chemistry building and I'd stayed in the chemistry building, and the being part of governance is what let me out.
And by this point Betsy was gone.
She was gone. I was in charge.
Right. And did you need, as academic staff, did you need permission from a supervisor to
Why am I laughing? Every academic staff has a supervisor, a.k.a. a chain holder. You're nodding your head.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard that expression. Somehow, I never got one. I never had a review. We had an uneasy relationship with chemistry in that early on in the Chemistry Learning Center, which went by the name of Chemistry Tutorial Program, one of the faculty members tried to take over the program and take the budget. He was not particularly well known for his bedside manner with students. He was known for grabbing power and money and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Dave Cronin, I believe he was dean at the time, said, no, they have their own program, they have their own budget, they're very good at what they're doing, and you're not going to take it over. That was sort of the beginning of nobody in chemistry would supervise me. It would be better to have the dean supervise me. And so I got budget authority. I got separate budget from chemistry, so they no longer could cut it. They tried again two more times. The 2-4-6 exercise, or was it the 6-8-10? It was cuts, 2%, 4%, 6%,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it was 8%. I don't know. There was some cuts in the 80s. Every school program department had to do it. And so chemistry decided it was going to do its cut by cutting us. And the dean said, no, they'll take their own cut. You take your own cut, but you may not cut them. And that was another reason why they just drew my supervising lines separate from chemistry. So long story short, I went from one dean to another as their charge. They were not the slightest bit interested in supervising me as such, but they're very interested in working with me for shared common goals on how students of color were treated on the campus, how teaching and learning went on, how we could intervene in the system. And don't ask, don't tell. I never asked them to supervise me. They never wanted to, but the line was drawn separate from chemistry. So that's why I never had a supervisor. I mean, I did, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall, and I should know this, who was the dean after Dave Cronin?
Dave Cronin. There was a dean for maybe only a year, then Phil Certain, who came from chemistry and I knew quite well. Then Gary Sandifer. And now Carl Schultz.
Right. So just four, well, four deans and one that was an interim.
Right, there was an interim in there.
Primary.
Yeah, four primary. And very important people to me were the associate deans. It was Alex Nagel, associate dean for the physical, for the natural sciences. And he had a wife in the academic staff. So he knew. It was Herb Wang, another great guy, Eric Wilcotts, who was just a joy to work with. So there were a lot of people in South Hall who got it in terms of, you know, you do a good job in the classroom. When you don't know something, like you're brought up as a white kid in a white neighborhood, you broaden your horizons so that you better understand and work with a whole bunch of people different from yourself. That's what we did. So we got along with the deans fine. Mm-hmm. We didn't always get along with chemistry. They kept trying. Then in another budget exercise, they tried to cut me. And then the joke was they called me in, I don't know, 5-10 years ago and said, you know, we've been through this before, Kathy. If we propose to cut you, the deans won't let us. So let's just make an agreement this time that we're not even going to try. And they were smiling. And I said, yeah, I think we've been there. We're going to agree that my budget's separate and you don't get to cut it. And he said, yes, you'll take your own cut. And I said, yes, I'll take my own cut. And they cut something else. So we eventually came to an understanding. Now, here's the memory part. It was really scary when the department you're in said, well, you're the part that's expendable.
Right.
I laugh and smile about it now, but it was a dean who backed me up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're a chemist by training.
Yeah, I am.
And to have your department, yeah, I can see where that would be.
So that's, again, where memory betrays the emotion and the hurt it felt at the time.
Right.
And I kind of smile and say, yeah, we reached an agreement, but that was over some years of strife.
Can I ask you something I forgot to ask? How did you become interested in chemistry in the first place?
Good question. I was an undergraduate at Cornell, and I was actually trying to major in physics, couldn't get in. I didn't really care what I did. I seemed to be good at just about everything. You know, science, English, I was an athlete, I was a musician, and I didn't really care what I did as long as I was going to end up being a high school teacher. Because that's what women did. I didn't want to be a nurse and I didn't want to be a secretary, so that was a high school teacher. And so I just picked a subject that I could get into the classes, seemed to enjoy doing, and chemistry was. I was good at it, but it wasn't the only thing I was good at. It was just, you know, one of these good students when I was 18.
So never an epiphany in K through 12 or undergrad that chemistry was the be-all, end-all.
No. And I had no idea that a PhD was a research degree. I had no idea that the reason you got one was to then go on and do beakers and flasks and test tubes and instruments and whatever we were doing back then, lions and tigers and bears, oh my.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea.
And again, that was part of, you mentioned earlier about being a graduate student in the 70s is different than being a prospective graduate student in the 70s is different than being a prospective graduate student today.
Right.
I suppose you could be naive about it if you wanted to, but there's a lot of information out there to...
Well, there was no internet.
Right.
I had no idea that college faculty members didn't necessarily teach. I didn't know that research universities were what they are.
All right, I wanted to make sure I got sort of the whole reason why you were a
chemist. The answer is, she doesn't know. It seemed as good as any subject.
So let's get back to a little bit more about academic staff. I couldn't find the minutes from that time, but there's an overview of academic staff during that period. They have a larger sort of history of academic staff for a certain time. That you were involved as a chapter in that. So first off, to get into acronyms. So at that point, there's ASIC. Is there also Academic Staff Assembly? Is there?
The assembly was there, and the chair of ASIC chaired the assembly, I guess, with the provost, although we didn't have a provost back there then. The person went under a different title. Associate Chancellor for Academic Affairs, I think. I remember calling Bascom, and one day they said, provost office. I said, we don't have a provost. When did this happen? I said, oh, yes, we do now. I said, okay.
And I mean, we've been talking about memory this whole time and how it can be a little fuzzy and, mm-hmm. and conflated. But it seems like during this time, at least one of the things that the executive committee and the assembly were working on was, let's see if I can find it here. Well, it says it here what you were talking about earlier too, which is getting more involvement into committees. You obviously told this story, but was that something that you recall being a leader on, or something that the group came together and saw this sort of void and tried to fill it?
I don't know what the group did. I just remember in some sense being pissed. What do you mean we can't even be in the room? We can't be at the table?
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed like to me, the right thing to do, and little did I know the opposition coming from the faculty. But it was more nuanced than that. We did get seated on committees, and I was one of the people who was the first person appointed to these committees. And I served on two or three of them. And the two quick stories I'll tell is that the academic staff tended to show up and do the work, and the faculty didn't. And that was threatening already, that the committees were getting taken over by who was actually doing the work on them. Okay, and the second part, and this is when I was on the Committee on Women, and Lucy Mathiak was on that. She eventually worked in South Hall, but she had been in international studies and programs. Judy Craig, Associate Dean at Letters and Science, was on that. Betsy Drain, faculty member in English, was on that. But the part I remember happening is none of the faculty women on the committee wanted to be chair. Judy Craig, who for many reasons would have made an excellent chair, volunteered, and the faculty decided to put a faculty man as the chair of the Committee on Women rather than letting an academic staff woman do it, and our three of us resigned the next week. Or at the end of our terms. But we said, we're off of this. This is silly. And today, by the way, it's a joint chair. There's both a academic staff and a faculty member chair. We don't care if they're men or women, but for a lot of the committees, they've gone, like the Teaching Academy. This was another case where academic staff were doing a lot of the work on the Teaching Academy, and they finally made joint co-chairs, a faculty and an academic staff. But at the beginning, it was just squabbles. So we learned how to get on committees together, and I think we do a much better job of it now.
Looking at your service, even before you were academic staff, you were on, according to your resume, you were on a Minority Recruitment and Retention Council?
Yes.
Is that different than a committee?
Yes. That is not a standing committee of the university. That was a group that I guess named itself, but all of the, I'll use the word MD again, because that's what we used, minority disadvantaged. All the MD coordinators would get together regularly. And we did that for years, like Gloria Dickerson in pharmacy and Gloria Hawkins, who now is back in another role in campus. She's got stories to tell, African-American woman. Lots of us got together and talked about what was happening to the students. Most of them were program directors in their own units. They were not, academics like we at the Chemistry Learning Center, we were chemists. The people at the Math Tutorials Center were mathematicians. The program directors knew things like career counseling and knew student advising, but they weren't, you know, like the person in pharmacy was not a pharmacist.
Now, was this a council that had sort of an official stamp and imprimatur, or was it that you all decided?
No, nothing official. Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody did it. I wasn't the person who did it. Somebody decided we were all together. So I guess the group got its name, and we met for years.
Yeah,
I still know a lot of those people, yeah.
And so it sounds like, and I'm involved in a couple of these, unofficial,
mm-hmm.
It's a good place to commiserate and be able to talk sort of freely without possible repercussion.
Yeah. Oh, we did a lot of talking. This was before the Madison Plan that was to increase diversity on campus, and then the second Madison Plan and the third one. I forget how many Madison Plan, you know, they have another name, but mm-hmm. Madison Plan is the first one I knew. But we were the ones looking out for the students, and students would often be seeing different ones of us, but we didn't know. Back then, there wasn't an advising system where you could go in and look to see who else the student had been talking to, so we all had to talk to each other to find out what our students were doing.
So before automation sort of helped,
mm-hmm.
automation or technology. So you're on academic staff assembly in the late, according to your resume, late 80s, early 90s, and then ASIC. So you're on assembly first.
I don't have much memory of being in the assembly.
Okay.
Apparently I was, but I don't have much memory of it.
Okay, so it's really ASIC where...
where I got going.
Okay. And you talked a little bit about getting on the University Committee on Women. It looks like you were also on a university committee for MD.
Mm-hmm.
Academic Affairs of Minority Disadvantaged Students.
Mm-hmm. Same issue. The staff were the people who showed up. Faculty were too busy doing other things. I don't know what they were doing, but we were the ones who tended to come to the meeting.
Mm-hmm. What about at that when you were on ASIC, was there talk then about mentoring? Any mentoring committees?
Yeah.
Was that a committee at that point?
I don't remember.
Okay. And at that point, was there talk about gender equity? Academic staff gender equity?
The part I remember was being the UW-Madison system rep, which was fascinating. We, you know, I didn't even know that system lived on the top floor of Van Hise, right? And one person from each campus would get together with, it happened to be Keith Sanders, who was one of Catherine Lyle's, I don't know what all their titles are for system. I really liked the folks up at System. I liked Catherine. I liked her chief budget officer, Kathy Sell. I thought Keith Sanders, who was former chancellor, was wonderful. Steve Porch was a character, but I liked him too. He was up at System in charge of academic affairs across. She had a cabinet of very good people. Smart, knew the system, personable, and knew more about academic staff than I did. And so Keith chaired this group of academic staff, and he did two things with me. One is he appointed me to the mission and roles. There's something on my resume about the Board of Regents, mission and roles.
Oh, yep. Study of the UW in the 21st Century, Mission and Roles Committee, 95 and 96.
Yeah, we used to spell that R-O-L-L-S instead of R-O-L-E-S. That was the joke of how many tumbles we took. But I got to address the Board of Regents and did so. But the other thing he got me chairing, along with Buff Schoenfeld, who was also up at Systems, she was a very high level administrative assistant to Catherine. Still know her too. We put together a study of the instructional academic staff at UW-Madison. We pulled the data and found out who they were and where they were, and what leapt out at us was that in the instructional staff, you know, that's category B, that's where the women were. So the lecturers tended to be the faculty wives who didn't get positions. There were people like me with, you know, PhDs in chemistry who didn't get faculty positions. And that a bulk of the teaching responsibilities disproportionately was going to women, actually, and people of color too. And the faculty in was by and large white men. And that's where the gender equity leapt out. And we had never done it. And Keith, bless his heart, I mean, he's up in system. He literally coached us to look under the rock and find it. He knew. But I did. I barely knew I was academic staff. I barely knew how this was all coming out. And he helped us discover, even though I think he knew what he was setting us on, to find the data where the people are. And I bet if I were to look somewhere in one of these shelves, I've still got a copy of that report.
What became of it once it was presented?
Beats me. Academic staff held on to it for a while. I really don't know where it ended up. I saw it a couple years ago, but I also moved offices, and I can't believe I threw it out, but I might have, figuring that somebody else had it too. But those were back before the days we had a lot of electronic stuff, so reports were in paper. But in essence, you looked at the who's a lecturer on campus, and the profile of the lecturers didn't match the profile of the faculty. Far more women, more people of color too. And we said, oh, here we are.
Right.
Here we are. So somewhere in that report of those years, does it say anything about that?
It appears around this, maybe the way it was before, these two, your two Board of Regent committee work.
No, I mean in the history of the academic staff.
Oh, right. That's a good question.
I'll mention one more thing after you look down the list.
No, I don't see it there. Doesn't mean it's not.
Part of the academic staff when I came on was really the governance was category A. And are those words familiar to you, category A and category B?
They're somewhat familiar to me, but I don't know who's going to listen to this, so if we could maybe build that out a little bit before you tell your story, the difference between category A and category B.
And actually there's a category C too.
Okay.
Category B, the one I was in, were the instructional academic staff. And they had a different set of policies and procedures that their salary ranges weren't capped. So of the academic staff, they were the ones that were most faculty-like. And of course that was true because to be in category B, you needed a degree in the field that you were instructing. So we tended to be, all have terminal degrees in our field. And there were quite a few of us. And I could list off a name. I mean, Laurie Martinberg in French and Italian comes to mind. So does Anne Wallace, who directed BioCore, Brad Hughes in the writing lab, myself in chemistry, the guy overdoing the math tutorial program. But we were instructional staff and also lecturers who did more, you know, I was in the faculty associate track. But that was one category, and we tended not to be in governance because we were busy doing our classroom thing with students and, in a lot of ways, interacting almost invisibly with the faculty. And the students didn't know we weren't professors. They all called us professor. They had no idea.
So so that's category B.
That's category B. Category A is the large category of academic staff who do a host of academic things on campus relating, ranging from computing to advising to directing and managing media programs, you know, like Bruno Browning, Learning Support Services. And category C was faculty who were put in administrative positions so that when you became, say, provost, I believe you got a category C academic staff appointment. You didn't give up your faculty, but the high-level administrators on campus got category C appointments. So they were pretty much off the table with academic staff. There were also some clinical professors out at the hospital, and I forget where all they fit. I'm guessing category B, but they were, again, very faculty-like, but they weren't. Their title was clinical professor, and they were mostly out in the medical school. But back to the storyline, category B tended to be missing in governance, and it was primarily category A who sat on ASEC with me, which might have been one of the reasons they needed me. Might be now in hindsight, they had to elect somebody from category B who was going to do it. But the issues that the staff tended to take up more were steered to who was represented, which was category A issues. And the big issue I remember looking at was boundary issues. They were trying, and they still try, to figure out the boundary between classified staff and academic staff. You know, who goes where? And DeWitt was the classic place. Should they be in the classified or should they be in the academic staff? And they're still, I think, fighting over who belongs in which bin. But there was some reclassification where they were going to take a whole bunch of one people and put them in another, and I've forgotten which way it went. But this people didn't like being reclassified because the title range, pay limits, the ceilings were different, and the job security you got in the two were different. So people had strong feelings. I was at the other boundary. I was at the boundary between faculty and academic staff. They were on the boundary between academic staff and classified staff. And the trouble with me was I did research, I had students, I did service, I had all the same things that a faculty member would do, but I looked like a duck, I flew like a duck, I quacked like a duck, but I wasn't a duck. And eventually I flew. But that was the boundary that was of more interest to me, and that's the boundary that Keith Sanders up at System said, Kathy, take a look at this one of instructional academic staff. Mm-hmm. So we did. And he gave me staff time. He gave Buff Schoenfeld, who was just a wonder, and we just dug it all out and looked at it and presented it back, and there it was. But again, this necessarily doesn't fit into the academic staff history because I think people were looking more toward the other boundary between classified and academic staff, and they were looking at representation, and they were looking at salary issues, which was different from those of us who were in the instructional academic staff. We were, in essence, adjunct faculty, but we're by state statute, unlike other states, we're not faculty. So we're not adjunct faculty. We're staff. So that was the set of issues I played with, and it surprised me, not in hindsight, that that's where we all were in terms of the people who were missing on the faculty were right there in the academic staff.
Was this, it sounds like, and I'll just ask you to confirm or however you want, one of the places where at the end of the last interview you said that getting involved in academic staff governance sort of opened your eyes.
Yes.
Is this one of the places where
this is one of the places. I didn't know I really was a duck, even though I was cracking and flying. And and I didn't know about UW System. People tended to badmouth System, and everybody I met up there I liked. And some of the friendships continue to this day. I miss Catherine, but one of my best friends on campus is still Kathy Sell, who then came down and we taught together. Oh, she's a fun person.
So that's another place within your academic staff governance that allowed you to meet a new group of people, obviously get to do some interesting things.
Exactly right. Meet a new group of people, see a bigger range of issues, understand what looked to me like equity issues from a much bigger perspective, and understand what an R1 university was, which, how would I know?
So, officially, looks like your academic staff executive committee time ended in 98. Was that just because you'd sort of run through the cycle of...
No, not at all. That's when our kid went in the hospital with leukemia.
Oh. Okay.
So I stepped down from being chair and I became mom for 150 days and nights with my husband, taking care of a kid who was going to die after the 8 months of it. And we kind of knew it. There are two kinds of leukemia, the good kind and the bad kind, and he had the bad kind. They still haven't figured out what to do with it. Childhood leukemia, acute, AML.
So you dropped everything then?
Yep, literally dropped everything and became mom. And that, to chemistry's credit, is where they were. They were good. Somebody who was a visiting professor, not one of the regulars, stepped in and taught my class. The Learning Center ran itself. I was able to actually come back to work now and then, which kept me sane after days and nights in the hospital. And you know, I mentioned to you that I was in the hospital this morning with a colleague who got a hip replaced, and actually everything I learned about how to work with nursing shifts and unit clerks and drug lines and pumps and all that, I was in the hospital this morning doing a little triage for her because she had been left alone and didn't know what was happening. So I went over to visit her, but went just dropped right back into the patient advocate role with a smile because I've done it. So a skill I didn't mean to learn, but that's how my morning got derailed and everything backed up. I stayed there till her pain was controlled and she had a great nurse on the shift and her tears had gone away and she was eating breakfast. Then I left.
So we talked earlier about how emotion, like you may not remember the memory, but you remember the sort of the emotion, the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Is it difficult for you to be in a hospital in situations like that? Because of what you're...
I want to say yes and no. The part is that this was in the late 90s. It's now almost 20 years later. Not quite. I did go back to the floor, mostly because I had lived there so long. I knew everybody. They knew us. It was unlike most hospital patients. You know, the kids, the hem-onc floor, hematology, oncology, was only on kids who were really, really sick. And that would be a leukemia kid. So most hospital people, like inpatients, you get them in, you get them out. You try to be nice to them. But for this group of kids, you know you're going to see them anywhere up to a year. And a good day, you can get them out of the hospital for a walk. So we, like Joel Wish, he was the clinical psychologist for John. He also took care of us. I still know Joel. He sat through my course last semester. He retired. We get together for lunch, and he still tells me stories of working at F44, and, you know, he saw it all, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got to see it for everybody who came in.
Yeah. Well, I really like Joel. I still do. And he's doing campus sustainability, and he's opening trash bags and recycling. He's being Joel. He's moved on from kids and whatever, and there are some amazing people.
So that takes us, in a sense, we've kind of been batting back and forth here, but that takes us to the late 90s in terms of academic staff. So maybe just a couple of questions about your progression, sort of your job progression through the 80s and 90s. And when we talked about that last, I think Betsy had left and you were director of...
Yeah, she left me in the lurch.
She left you in the lurch, yes.
As I continue to remind her.
But you were also sort of moving up in that academic staff category, or that the associate faculty associate.
Good job.
Thank you. So does that just happen? Do you have to apply for that? How do you start to move up in terms of
these your days title? Every 5 or 6 years they look at you and automatically reclassify you. My days, I would go to chemistry and say, it's time to move from associate to full, and they would say, no, and I'd say, yes, and they'd turn me down, and then I'd go back the next year, and then I'd get a dean to help me, and then, you know, eventually I said, distinguished prefix. I was one of the first on the campus, and they said no, and I said yes. I said, look, I'm just going to go get it done, and so I put my packet in. It was immediately put through, and then I got put on the committee for the next... I don't know, 6 years, 9 years. I was on that Distinguished Prefix Committee for a long time, working with another wonderful person on campus, Phil Pelletieri, the bug man. Mm. Have you interviewed him?
Mm-mm. He's on the list, but no.
Yes! I mean, you'll just go away smiling when he tells you how many calls he gets in one afternoon on ladybugs. Lady beetles, sorry. I got stung by a bee in Amsterdam in March, right here in the elbow. It took my hand out to the fingers. You know, I just looked like a big sausage in pain. Came back and said, Phil, what the hell bit me? And he said, well, didn't you bring me the bug? And I said, no, we flushed it down the toilet. But it was a bee and a group of tulips that came out. And, you know, good to Phil. He wants to see the bug. So Phil was chair of the Distinguished Prefix Committee. And I served with him, and we looked at every packet in the world that was badly prepared for the wrong reasons and tried to sort through them to get people a title that they deserved in spite of the bad preparation of the packet, or to stop and say, you know, this one really doesn't fit. So I left ASEC, but I landed on the physical sciences distinguished prefix, or maybe it was the whole campus, I don't know. And then I landed on the CASI for letters and science chair to put in the awards with the dean for academic staff at the college level. And again, he coached me. We said, can we have one or two awards? He said, why not five? And I think there's seven now, but he, you know, we weren't thinking big enough. And then I won one of them.
Can you talk a little bit about what CASI is, starting with the acronym itself? It's College and...
Committee on Academic Staff Issues.
Right.
So somewhere that should be in the history of the academic staff,
right,
that since so much of the action was at the schools and colleges, each one of those should have a high-level academic staff committee that meets with the dean on a monthly basis, elected. And sure enough, I got elected, and then I chaired it. Bruno was on that too. If you haven't met Bruno Browning, Timothy Browning, Bruno. Fun guy. Wears purple.
So what CASI were you?
Letters
you
and Science.
Okay, so you were on the LNS. Yeah, because that's where your the center is. And so title sounds like it was another time where people were trying to put forth roadblocks.
Oh, they did. They said no, and I said yes, and I got used to being told no, and then just wait and get it turned to yes. But I must have... I guess I was patient, but not that patient. The chair once told me, we don't need to give you jobs. This was to get an indefinite appointment, which I also held. One of the few in the College of Letters and Science. And chemistry chair said to me, we don't need, you have job security. We don't need to formalize this in any way. And now the procedures are much more regular. Much more regular. They just do it. They don't grant many indefinite appointments, but the distinguished prefix is much more normal. And some of us went first. I was one of the people who went first.
I actually just saw an email from Heather Daniels, so Secretary of Academic Staff, about distinguished prefixes. So I think it is
I might have been the first in LNS, but then I pulled a whole bunch of people in after me.
They're actually, instead of talking about your work life in the 80s and 90s, there was one other thing I wanted to ask for sure, and that was you got more education, I believe.
Yes.
You got a master's degree. Why?
Why?
Yeah.
One thing led to another. So Betsy had a degree in education, and she finally said, you know, I bet you'd like the School of Education. Go, you know, she's the one who pushed me into ASEX. What do I have to blame this woman for? Or thank her for? And she said, go over and see the folks in education. And I went over and met a couple of cool people over there. They're all retired now. And they just said, you know, in essence, why'd you stay for a master's degree? And the way I explained it to other folks was, I think the same way I explained it to you on the earlier tape. When I would solve my students' chemistry problems, they often brought me their life problems. So I ended up getting better listening skills, learning more about resources, getting a little better when to get the alarm bells to go off for things like suicide. To trust those alarm bells, to figure out where in the system to get students to somebody who was trained in it, even though I wasn't. And I got a master's degree in cross-cultural counseling psychology or something like that. And it was fun because I took one course a semester. I picked only the people I wanted to study with and enjoyed it immensely, and it got me out of chemistry. You see the theme in my professional life. Since I couldn't be all that happy there all the time, I just kept going other places because nobody was paying much, really, they weren't paying much attention to what I was doing as long as I did my job well, and I did. And I had intellectual time and fun to burn. So I went and did it.
Mm-hmm. Any specific class or specific professor that stood out during that time?
Well, there's one. His name was Jim Lee, and he is now retired. In fact, he's not even alive anymore. And he was the one, if you look over there on the wall, there's a document with a bunch of Japanese writing on it. And that's an Aikido document. Aikido is a martial art. And he kept telling me how Aikido was a way of harmony where you took your opponent's energy, you blended with it, and they were down and you were up, is the long story. So I went over to I was in my late 30s, went to the dojo. Dojo means mat in Japanese. It also means building that holds the mat. And it also means world that holds the building that holds the mat. Or so they tell me. And I went over and signed up. I went once and stayed. And now I'm an instructor in Aikido. That's my rank and level. I've been there 25 years. I disappear from campus every Tuesday to teach the noon class. But then 6 months later, Jim Lee said, I'm coming too. Now, he's an older guy, 10 years older than I was. He smoked. He was athletic. And he got on the mat. And the two of us had so much fun doing Aikido, which wasn't all that different than doing counseling. Because you take whatever somebody gives you and you work with it. That's what I did in the hospital this morning. I took what they gave me and tried to work with it. So that was somebody I met who became a friend for life. I knew his kids, his wife, his family. And he was a darn good teacher to me as well. But I'm the one who said, ah, Jim, you talk a good line, but get your body on the mat. Mm-hmm. And he did.
So that's another avenue or opportunity where getting out of chemistry opened up a...
Yes. You're pulling out correctly a theme. Aikido was another one. Oh, it's so much fun.
How long did it take you to move from being a student to being a teacher?
Well, it depends.
Or do they call it that?
Whoever the senior person in the mat instructs, and I think you know faculty or even academic staff, that those of us who teach will teach anything, whether we know anything or not. So Jim and I had only been probably students for 3 years, and for some reason the instructor didn't show up, and he looks at me and I look at him and said, well, let's go, rock and roll. And so the two of us merrily taught the class. Now, we're not supposed to be teaching as little white belts, but we tended to overdrive it. We had a great time. And now, I mean, normally instructor rank would be, again, whoever's the senior person in the room, but much particularly several black belts. Yeah, you can teach it. You can teach with a black belt, but you're not very good. Black belt is like a PhD. It all it means is you're a beginner. You've known enough to stand up and pretend you know something, but you train another 5 or 10 years, and then you might know a little bit. Or I'd say it another way, none of us know nothing.
How have you applied what you've learned in Aikido to your teaching and your day-to-day
interactions? Duck. Don't get hit. That's what I've learned. When somebody's throwing a punch, step back. Step under. The karate people know how to hit and kick, and they, you know, break boards and hurt their hands and their feet, and we duck. So actually, they're very good arts to combine together. That people who know how to hit and kick with somebody who knows how to get out of the way. You know, admittedly, you can't always get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And people like me, my hands aren't any good for hitting anybody. You got to be kidding. Betsy said, put your teeth in their ankle.
Always good advice.
And that's metaphorically what she did for years. She just didn't let go. I've never bit anybody's ankle.
Actually or metaphorically?
I might have metaphorically put my teeth in a few ankles.
The other thing I think you said just a few minutes ago, too, that this might have taught you is how to take what's given.
Yeah. That's what you do. You always got a partner, and they're always doing something, and you deal with what you got.
A couple more things from this time period. You alluded to one of them was you won an award. Actually, you earned some grants during this time period, too, which I wanted to talk about. A couple of, in terms of dollars, small, but then a couple larger ones, at least in the humanities, these are large amounts of money. The proposal to meet the needs of at-risk students. You got undergraduate initiative funds a couple of times in the 90s, which is just part of bringing in extra money for the work you were doing at the center.
Mm-hmm.
Would that allow you to bring in additional staff?
They all hired staff. We started with Betsy and me. And now the Learning Center is a staff of, I don't know, 7 FTEs, give or take. 6.5. And so we had lots of friends on campus who knew us because the students told them about us. And when this is why it's a good reason to be out of your box. If you're in your box, you don't know that there's funds available to tap for students. If you're out running around and eating lunch with these people, and say, Kathy, could you deal with an extra $50,000 or $100,000 to do what you do? I'd say, I think I know what to do with that.
And you also alluded to that you won a couple of awards during this time period. I'm trying to find the honors and awards. Here we go. The Award for Excellence in Leadership, and then I think that's the one in 1996. Is that different from what you remember of the awards you said you won? So now I'm getting this all confused. Anyway, so an Award for Excellence in Leadership from the Alumni Association.
That's one of the campus academic staff awards. There weren't very many back then, and there are a lot more now, and that's good because there's an awful lot of amazing academic staff people. That leadership award now is 2 leadership awards. One is at the unit level and one is at the campus level. But yeah, I got that one. I got the one in the College of Letters and Science, and the recognition was both wonderful in the sense that it always feels good, but it also came with $5,000 that goes into your salary. So they backed up those awards with, I mean, you've been through, I think, as long as you've been here, a lot of years with no pay raises.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, furloughs. And so have you ever gotten a campus-wide academic staff award?
I have not. I've applied for and gotten a couple of grants, actually. Yeah, two, which has been nice.
So here's an offer on the table. There's a number of people, I bet, and I'm one of them, who you've talked to and the projects you've worked on that would say what you've done puts you very competitive. And I'm good at writing letters. I've probably written more letters for people on Lisi LNS awards than anybody else on campus.
Thank you. I will, I just might take you up on that.
Yeah, well, please do. Somebody in your unit should nominate you, and I'm actually pretty good at saying, you know, you meet a person now and then who's good at what you do and you appreciate it, and then you realize that person fits in a bigger system, not just talking to you, but, and so here's why this person is good.
Thanks.
But I have a hunch you fit in that category.
Well.
Hidden in plain sight is what I often say.
That's a great.
That would be a librarian hidden in plain
mm-hmm.
sight.
I think that's probably, not to end, you know, trying
yeah.
to make me feel better, but it might be a good point to stop, and then I think for our last session, we'll look at the last, you know, 10 to 12 years, the 2000s.
Sounds like a plan.
Anything on your mind, though, that you want to get on the record before we end for the day?
No, this was the nicest part of the day so far after reliving traumas at the hospital this morning.
Oh, I'm glad I could.
So here's the
thing
to put on the record.
Okay.
You never know when something happens in your life of any variety, how it's going to be useful later on. And that's certainly been a thread in my life, that who would have known that all the skills I got at being really good in dealing with hospitals have been actually a big help in understanding my students in hospitals and having a colleague in the hospital this morning. And that's just one example of, you just never know how the pieces are going to fit together later.
Okay.
So we'll end with that.
Great. Well, this concludes the second interview with Kathy Minkamp. Kathy, thank you for your time.